This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start the hour today with spring, a welcome focus after a tough day in the news today. As I was walking into the studio, it was 63 degrees in Boston. The skies are blue. And as the weather is warming up, so are the turkeys. Have you seen them? Run into them? Stopped your car for them? Dodged them? Well, April to June is mating season for the birds. The young ones are often called Jakes and Jennies, and you'd be wise to watch out for Jake and Jenny. So, have you had a close encounter with this proud living poultry? Do you have questions about what to do if you encounter a turkey on a walk, say, or in the street? We have answers. You can tweet us at Radio Boston or call us. The number 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now, Keith Tosi, animal officer for the Natick Police Department. Keith, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. I have to ask you, does this feel like a very turkey-laden spring to you, or are you kind of used to this turkey presence?
I'd have to say kind of used to it. Nothing, knock on wood so far, has come out as anything out of the ordinary, so hopefully it's just another oh-hum kind of year for the turkeys in Natick.
All right. So listen, several years ago, I went to an office to meet someone, and a greeter came out to meet me, and the person was kind of all scratched up. And when I asked him what happened, he said he'd been out hunting, and he had encountered a wild turkey. And I was stunned by how beat up this guy was. It almost feels strange to say it, but turkeys, especially during mating season, can be a little bit dangerous, right?
They can be aggressive, sure. Yeah. And they tell you to be bold. Stand your ground is sometimes the best defense.
Sounds like a coyote, almost, or a bear, but turkeys aren't predators, so why does it make sense to stand your ground?
Because you're bigger than them, and they feel like with any wild animal, especially with bears, especially, they say standing your ground is an intimidation factor to them that you mean business as well. So sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. They are unpredictable, they're wild animals, so... You know, but it is when you're alone in the woods, and sometimes that's your only defense other than maybe to run away. But they can fly. They can fly up to 55 miles an hour for short distances, so sometimes that's not an option.
I had no idea. So out there, have you encountered a turkey, whether standing still or flying at 55 miles an hour, and wondered what to do? Are you not sure about how to handle a flock that's kind of hanging in your neighborhood? 1-800-423-8255, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Keith, earlier today we spoke with David Scarpetti, who is a wildlife biologist at Massachusetts Fisheries and Wildlife. And David was telling us that in some cases, wild turkeys can display hyper-aggressive behavior during this season. Here he is.
They do a couple different things. They generally start following people around. And what they're doing is they're trying to kind of push those people away from kind of their core area, right? And in doing so, you know, again, they're going to run, they might peck, they might use the spurs, which are little bony protrusions on the back of their legs, flap their wings, kind of stand really tall and erect. Again, it's all just a means for intimidation. And sometimes that intimidation gets to the point where there is some physical contact.
So what of that first tracks most with your experience, Keith? What do you tend to see from aggressive turkeys during mating season like this?
We have yet to run into it here, thank God, but I have heard of it happening. And, you know, if you're in your backyard, the best defense is sometimes your dog. If you have a dog, putting it on a leash and maybe having it roam the area will keep them at bay, especially that hyperness. And we have seen it before, and it's a thing with them with mating, and especially to protect their ground, they're going to stand their ground at whatever all cost possible. And sometimes they can be super aggressive.
When you've seen that before, do you have to relocate the turkey? Do you, you know, like I know I've seen an animal control officer, for example, respond to a call with a raccoon who's in a trash can or scaring someone or out during the day. What does it look like when you have to intervene in a situation where you get called by about a turkey? Or is it never necessary? Can people pretty much always handle it on their own?
No, sometimes they will call us, and if we get there and he's super aggressive, again, we're governed by the state on what we can and can't do and intervene in wildlife. Unless the animal is sick or injured, we really can't relocate. It's illegal to relocate wildlife in Massachusetts, so what we try to do is get the people away and let the animal go off on its own and use that approach more than anything.
And what should one never do with domesticated, we're talking about wild turkeys, but sort of wild turkeys in your domestic environment, your yard, your neighborhood, your sidewalk, et cetera?
I tell this to people all the time, especially with any wild animals. Bird feeders are the nemesis. As much as we love the birds and they come and they look pretty, they attract a whole host of wildlife. And that wildlife attracts bigger wildlife. So I always tell people, if you don't want these animals hanging around your yard, get the bird feeders inside. Don't feed your pets outside. Just the simple things, some housekeeping, will go a long way. You're probably not going to prevent them from passing through, but they won't be camping out there ruining your Sunday plans or your weekend plans to spend with the kids out in the backyard. They're just going to pass through because they're going to go where the food is. They're opportunistic feeders like anything else. They're going to go where the food is, and if there's no food available there, they're going to move along.
So we're talking to Animal Officer Keith Tosi from the Natick Police Department. Keith, I can hear, a burgeoning bird watcher out there, or somebody who really enjoys the robins and the cardinals and the blue jays in their backyard, feeling really sad that they can't put a bird feeder out. Is there really no way to put something out? And what about the hummingbirds, right? Those little, those liquid feeders that the hummingbirds come for?
Yeah, the liquid feeder is not so much. It's the spill of the seed. Unless you're really attentive at your bird feeders, if you're really a bird enthusiast, those people, they usually don't worry about it because they know the ramifications. So they're out there. They usually will have feeders that will collect the spillage, or they're out there cleaning up the spillage to prevent such an incident. But on average, if it's just the usual citizen like myself who just wants to feed the birds and do their part, this is what really attracts the animals, is the spillage that you see with the feeders, especially multiple feeders.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To ask your questions about how to handle wild turkeys in your area, or share that story of the time recently that you had to stop in the street while what seemed like a parade of turkeys came walking by. You can tell that I've had this encounter recently. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So I do have a couple more questions for you here, Keith. And I want to go back to this idea of the abundance of wild turkeys we're seeing. I was actually amazed in preparing for today to find out that wild turkeys were once almost completely wiped out in the area until conservationists stepped in. I talked earlier about speaking with David Scarpetti, wildlife biologist at Massachusetts Fisheries and Wildlife, one of our producers did earlier today, and he brought home the magnitude of what we are dealing with now. Here he is.
Over that 45, 50-year period, we've gone from zero turkeys to, somewhere around 35,000 or more turkeys statewide. They're in every single town in Massachusetts, with the exception of the island of Nantucket. And so it's just been this great success story that's come with, a little bit of baggage in that, again, they are very abundant in suburban and urban areas. And we do get, a lot of conflict, whether it be just kind of simple nuisance issues or, again, some of those more serious public safety issues that arise during breeding season.
So I guess I wonder, Keith, as an animal officer, two questions. First, do you approach these animals with a kind of affection because they're your world and you're being called out to address them and you're seeing how they affect your community, or just kind of a piece of the work? And two, do you feel that we've gotten to a point where the wild turkeys are a nuisance, or is it just the quirk of living with a species that we worked hard to bring back?
I think it's a little of both. Personally, they can be a nuisance. I don't think they're. It depends on what community you're into as well. You could go a town over and maybe be dealing with it worse than you are. So, I think it's a little of both. Are they overpopulated? Maybe a little bit. But what was the alternative back in 1851 when they were pretty much wiped off from Massachusetts or New England? So you got to find that middle ground. And I don't think you're going to get that anymore. Hunting's on the decline. The areas to hunt is on the decline. And believe it or not, we're finding that wild animals are adapting more to this urban setting than they would be if they had to forage in the woods, because we provide a lot of the meals for them without even realizing it. And, that why would you go forage for food when you can go to somebody's house and, again, I hearken to the bird feeder or the feeding the pets outside or the beautiful bushes and shrubs we plant around our yard. You can get anything you want. So they kind of thrive in this setting than they would be if they were left alone out in the woods by themselves. And they adapt. And all animals, especially the turkey, have learned to adapt to this setting.
So Fred is calling from Danvers. Fred, what's your turkey story?
Right. I was on my way to work. This is Fred in Tyler. I'm a nurse. So on my way to work this morning, I met a group of turkeys, and what was interesting is that the two males, one male blocked the traffic going the other side, and then the other male blocked the traffic going the other side, and they were flexing their feathers, and I couldn't, you know, go around them. So for about a few minutes, and they gave way, and so it was really nice to see the males protecting the other group, you know.
Thanks for that call, Fred. I appreciate it. And this is protecting behavior. How soon, Keith, should we expect to see babies that the males and females are protecting as well?
Well, they usually mate from about mid-March till about the first week of June, end of May. And then you'll start seeing usually about a dozen or so eggs after that. And about 28 days after that, they should start hatching.
And what are the threats to them in hatching? You know, do we have to worry about cold weather, predatory animals? Should you watch your cats and dogs in your backyard if there is a turkey nest nearby?
They usually won't do that. Like bunnies typically will nest in you know, weird areas in your yard where potentially your dogs or cats can find them. Turkeys, we find, usually don't do that. They're aware of their surroundings, so they're usually deeper in the woods, usually under a good canopy of cover of woods, so nothing can really get to them. So their only, you know, predator would be coyotes, foxes, fishers, stuff like that.
They sound pretty savvy. All right, we've got Lindsay on the line in Watertown. Lindsay has a question. Go ahead.
Hi. I am very terrified of birds. I had an experience with turkeys where I was running through Brookline, and I saw them on the sidewalk across the street. I tried to give them a wide berth, just, you know, keep going on my way and not get in their way. But they actually crossed the street and started surrounding me. Eventually, another runner came help me. But I'm just wondering, is that typical that they kind of seek you out even when you try to avoid them? And I heard you earlier say stand your ground, but I was very scared, didn't feel very brave. So I'm just wondering what other kind of advice you have.
Great. Thanks for the call. Keith, over to you.
Yeah, so loud noises, if you have it. I know if you're running it, that's probably not an option. You're just, you know, running with yourself. But if you're running with a group, there's strength in numbers. But again, be bold if you can try. I know it's easier said than done, but they tell us to be bold, stand your ground, and hopefully they'll reroute or go another way. If you can run and get away, get away. But sometimes they are super aggressive. They are wild animals. They're unpredictable. So we also tell people, like anything else, check your surroundings. If you see them from a distance, you know, reroute your course a little bit to kind of go around them.
Yeah, this sounds like no messing around.
Yeah, and sometimes it just happens, and there's nothing you really can do except, you know, deal with it. And sometimes we've had some minor injuries. The fortunate part is they're not superly aggressive where they're really going to do a lot of damage to you other than minor, maybe a cuts or bruise. But our biggest problem is secondary injuries. We don't want people getting forced out into the street where they can potentially be struck by a car or something like that. That's our biggest danger, more so than the bird.
I hadn't even thought of that. Okay, just lightning round quick question. Have you had any nuisance calls yet this year on turkeys?
We have not, so we're hoping that continues. Again, people are kind of used to them, so they've grown patient with them. So if they're crossing the street, they'll give them their time to get across the street and move along. People can go along their way.
All right, that is Keith Tosi, animal officer for the Natick Police Department. Keith, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, ma'am. Have a good day.
Cambridge's first recreational marijuana shop opened today, 6 years after it became legal and 4 years after the state's first shop opened. So what took so long? Well, Cambridge doubled down on making sure that its first shop was run by an equity applicant, in this case, two applicants. That's someone who represents a community or population disproportionately harmed by marijuana law enforcement. Sia Samura, and Sean Hope, owners of Yamba Market, are in a small crowd. According to the Joint Committee on Cannabis Policy, only 6% of the recreational licenses in Massachusetts have gone to people in one of the state's two equity programs. And Massachusetts was supposed to be a pioneer in finding diverse and inclusive ways to legalize marijuana. Sia Samura, the CEO of Yamba Market, is with us on the line. Sia, welcome to Radio Boston.
Greetings, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really good of you to join us on your first day in business. How is it going? Are you busy?
Yeah, very exciting first day here. You know, it was raining in the beginning part of the day. And as the rain kind of dried up and the sun came out, the folks came out too. And so we've been just having a great time seeing people that we've known through the past several years, all stopping by to see us, family members, friends. It's just very validating, and we're blessed.
So this is personal for you, this business. You're a war veteran. You found medical cannabis after returning from war. You and your wife worked together in this realm. What does it mean to you to be finally open? Was there a moment today, Sia, where you sort of stopped and took it all in?
Absolutely. A big, long and tough road getting to the opening day here. You know, we are in an extremely restrictive industry. And as you know, it's very hard to get off and started in the cannabis industry here in Massachusetts. It costs a lot of money. There are a lot of restrictions and obstacles, and the bar for entry is relatively high. So, you know, we've had to really be serious about what we've been doing the past several years to get to this point. And, you know, finally being here, it is, like I say, validating, but it's also exciting because now we get to prove who we are in the market and to the communities that we've been parts of.
And you're in a big space. You've got a dispensary there. It's, you know, 21 and over. You have security, but you've also got event space in the building. You've got an art space. Why put all of that together in Cambridge like this?
Thanks for the question. And it's because, you know, like I said, we are an emerging industry, but also, as you mentioned, we're an economic empowerment company, and we're one of the few. And so we have a special role in the market out here in Massachusetts, and that's to create a more equitable and healthy market for everyone. And it's really the economic empowerment licensees and that program is really the main engine, I believe, for equity in the state. And so us coming into that, this space and this license allows us to do so much and continue to lead towards an equitable market. And so why do we have over 5,800 square feet, a dynamic community space, you know, and kind of a different feel? It's because we see ourselves as a headquarters for the emerging and evolving local cannabis culture, worldwide cannabis culture that's now finding itself rapidly being legalized. We are, you know, a place where we want to regularly introduce products and services to folks who have been denied that opportunity. And so at Yamba Market, we'll be able to introduce people to so much and really educate, get rid of stigma, and change the field.
Mindful that the stigma is still there and that for some it's still controversial with the use of recreational marijuana. Have you received any pushback for co-locating public art space, event space with an over 21 business? And if so, how have you addressed that?
No real pushback, just the normal regular restrictions and obstacles to businesses, and these businesses in particular here in Cambridge. You know, these businesses have been a long time coming. Consumers have been waiting for adult use cannabis in Cambridge and throughout the Commonwealth. So, I mean, people are looking forward to what we're going to be able to do here. And all of the dynamic space is really welcoming of our different audiences and communities. So if you're in the business, you have a product or service to promote, we actually have space to incorporate that, to support you in that. If you're a consumer, you want to come and learn more about the dynamic industry and how it's changing, we can support you there too.
Is it changing, Sia? So 4 years, and I don't mean that skeptically, that's a genuine question. 4 years for you to get from point A to point open. We've had a lot of conversation here on Radio Boston since the legalization of recreational marijuana about both the intention to bring forward equity licenses, to bring forward businesses that write the disproportionate impact of marijuana law enforcement and how hard that's been. Is it changing?
Well, it's definitely changed, especially, you know, as my team enters the field, we bring a different orientation to what we're doing here as a licensed retailer. And you know, we do represent kind of a main face for the social equity programs here in Massachusetts. We have a lot of people kind of looking at us, and we were really only allowed to open here in Cambridge because we were, and we are, an economic empowerment company, and Cambridge has decided to support those these licensees. So, I mean, we're in a unique position that we could really only be in because of these equity policies that have been created by the voters and the rest here. You know, but we're here to encourage more people into the business, and we're here to lead and bring down the barrier to entry.
What is it like to be that face? I mean, you're right. There are states watching all over the country. We're seeing increased legalization of marijuana, despite the fact that it's still illegal federally. And people watch Massachusetts. We were supposed to be the innovative leader in equity approaches. Are you proud? Do you feel pressure? What is that like for you?
You know, so both of those. I'm proud. I do feel pressure. I'm just one operator, just one voice out here, you know, trying to change the reality. But we are. And, you know, we are hiring folks, hiring people who are very excited about this new industry and really exerting themselves and showing us who they are. But change is coming slow. And I think as you see the legislature, state legislature, starting to pick up some of the issues that we've cared about just recently, kind of shows and proves that we've been educating, the stigma is starting to drop, and our electeds realize the obligations they have to these businesses and consumers.
A bill approved just last week in the state Senate does try to make some changes. One of them is creating a fund, a social equity trust fund, to help with the huge capital startup costs that everybody faces in starting recreational marijuana businesses and have proven particularly difficult for entrepreneurs of color. Does it go far enough? Are you excited about it? And do you expect the House to pass it as well?
I mean, it's long overdue. And I think, you know, capital, money, support, financial support to economic empowerment and social equity oriented cannabis businesses really should have started from the very beginning. I think we're seeing even the electeds now are starting to understand it was a mistake to, you know, to speak about cannabis social equity, to support it, and then not really support capital or finances going towards the same issue. And so now it's coming back around. We've always called for these funds. We've always called for some feedback in the industry to support more equitable measures and others to get in. But now our electeds are finally talking about it. And so I think that is change. And while our Commonwealth electeds are talking about this change and moving this bill forward, there's a national conversation that's going on as well. And so, I mean, this is what change is. You know, it's hand in hand with culture. And we're experiencing it. We're part of it. And we're excited to keep moving it forward. You know, we feel proud. We have a social justice role in the cannabis industry. And that's fact. There are very few other industries that are built like ours and that have such a reparative role on society like we do.
That is Sia Samura. He is the CEO of Yamba Market, opened in Cambridge today. Thank you for stepping out of what sounds like a busy first day to talk with us. Sia, good luck with the business.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right, stay with us, folks. Coming up after a break, we dive into the life of a lifelong Somerville swimmer. She broke records, she won championships, and now 70 years later, they've named a local pool after her. Virginia Ginny Smithers Sanders joins us now. Somerville named the pool at the John F. Kennedy School there in her honor roughly 70 years after she first made waves as a young swimmer. Ginny, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Oh, there's so many stories for you to tell us. I can't wait. I just want to start by asking you, as such a swimmer, what does it mean to have a pool named after you?
It's crazy. It's 70 years later. It's like, wow. You know, are they serious? Is this a dream? It's both humbling and really, really exciting. And it's a great pool. pool.
What makes it a great pool?
Well, it's perfect for competitive swimming, and there's a teaching pool that's warmer. And I love that it's in an elementary school because the kids can learn how to swim, and they're doing a Learn to Swim program.
So I'm just intrigued as a non-swimmer. You just said that the learning pool, the teaching pool, is warmer. I guess I would have assumed that competitive swimming would want warm water, but it sounds like that's not the case.
No, no. Believe it or not, you can even sweat in the water. So, no.
So you want cold water?
Well, no. Let's get real here.
Good.
No. So your husband was a swimmer and you're a non-swimmer. I was a swimmer and my husband is a non-swimmer.
Oh, no kidding.
We have that in common.
Yeah, so the first time my husband saw me swim, he said, "Oh, honey, I didn't know you were that bad." And I tried to warn him. But you were incredible, and it started young, and I want to go there. So you're 11 years old. You become the youngest swimmer ever to win the 1,500-meter New England Championship. And I was trying to picture that this morning, and I was wondering now, did you know when you got in the pool that you were that fast and you were like, yeah, I'm going to win this and I'm going to be this fast? Or did you surprise yourself?
Well, it was very surprising. It was at Horn Pond with setups at 50 meters. It was not in a pool, and it was all measured out properly. And I had no clue. I never, ever competed against other people, ever. I've always competed against the clock. So when I would say to a girl on either side of me, "Good luck, swim as fast as you can," I meant it because it had no bearing on me. It was the time that had the bearing on me.
So how come you were so fast? Was your stroke different? Were you just an incredible athlete? Why were you so fast?
I was hungry.
You wanted to win.
Well, my life was both wonderful and less than. You know, I was crazy about and loved my father, a Capitol policeman, so much, a great man. And he was a man that on holidays would become a Jekyll and Hyde drunk. Mm. And so we initially lived in Medford, and my older brother and I, he was my best friend, would climb the chain link fence and sneak into the swimming pool. And first I'd sink to the bottom, and he'd say, "Push towards the bottom, it'll keep you up." And I sure did, and it kept me up. And that's what started me. And during a Labor Day at 9, just before turning 10, during a Labor Day, my father did his Jekyll Hyde. And after all the noise settled down, my mother said, "Go to the pool and go climb that fence. Go win something, for God's sakes." So I went to the pool. The lifeguards knew me. So my mother said, "I have to swim. There's only 100-meter 16 and under boys left." I said, "Fine."
And
I won it.
No, okay, so okay. I need to give some context to our listeners. You're born in 1937, so you're doing this swimming. 80 gold medals by age 15.
Yes.
At a very different time. Was there backlash? Was it hard to swim competitively in a boys' world? Was there pressure on you? I'm fascinated by this.
No, I loved it. My world was a boys' world. I had no girls in the neighborhood. I was a good little athlete. My brother was my best friend. He chose me to be his partner in anything. He had what I would call now ADHD athleticism. In the middle of one season, he's Rex next one, and I'd be his partner for that. But I loved it. I just loved the competitiveness of it. I loved every bit of it. And, you know, in the beginning, the gentleman that saw me win that race was an AAU, now it's USA Swimming, but an AAU official and Coach Metropolitan Swim Club in Southie, and said, "Who is that kid?" And that was a month before I turned 10. That first year, there were CYO titles. By 11, I was the youngest girl to ever win that 1,500 meters. Surprised me. No end. All I knew is I get in, and I swam as fast as I could.
So there's fast, and then there's dominant. And you were dominant. I mean, again, 80 medals by 15, that's more than fast. Was there an Olympic dream there, a professional dream?
Well, I would love to have gone to the Olympics. And then we're talking ancient history now and different times, very different times. And in 1952, they had the Olympic trials for Helsinki. The Western Seaboard trials were in L.A., Eastern Seaboard in Boston, sponsored by the Boston Herald American. Final tryouts in Indianapolis, and the winners were supposed to be sent to Indianapolis. Well, the Boston Herald American backed out financially, and we were not. My father was a Capitol policeman. We were.
Wow.
We didn't know. We didn't you don't know what you don't know, and we didn't know with all the championships already behind me that if we had approached the Lions Club or Rotary, they would have sponsored it. We just didn't know, so I just figured that's just the way that goes.
So you never got Although your shot.
No, but my times would have done very well in Helsinki, and I love that competition of the clock. But, you know, it didn't happen, so it didn't happen. That was before Title IX, you know, a couple of years later, when there was no hope of going to college on a scholarship. There were no scholarships. So, you know, my father died when I was 16, and I lost a lot of interest in swimming and knew that I'd have to pay for college if I wanted to go. That little bit of insurance money was saved for my younger brother, and my mother said, I expect room and board from you. 2 weeks after you graduate from high school, get a job at John Hancock like everyone else. I said, I'm going to college, Mama.
And you
I'm
did.
I'm going, and I did.
When did you get back in a pool again?
I never left the pool until I just couldn't do it anymore because of cancer.
And you're a fighter. So your daughter, for some may know that your daughter-in-law, Maria Stefano, some may know her. She's from WCVB-TV. She told us that you survived cancers more times than someone can imagine. You married a Hall of Famer Celtic player, and you were a dean at Northeastern. You're fierce.
Yeah, it feels good.
And do you feel fierce now? What are you fierce about?
I'm fierce every day. I'm so surprised that I wake up and I'm not dead. And it's just, I have so many things wrong with me, and I'm here against all odds. I mean, I left Dana Farber to come here. You know, life is crazy, and I am here. But I will admit, when I wake up before Satch and I stretch, I say, I'm still alive. And my next thought is, how soon can I take a nap? And I'm not out of bed.
All right. So this pool in Somerville, how did you find out they were naming it after you? And who led the charge?
Well, I was contacted by people from Mayor Curitano's office initially, although Mayor Ballantyne is in office now and she was charming. But they set up a committee to honor people who have really brought distinction and something special to the city of Somerville. And when they were coming up with candidates, my name came up because I was the only female in their City of Somerville Hall of Fame. Hmm. And it was unanimous that they choose me, so they set the process going to let me know, and Maria was very helpful in facilitating all of that because Maria is a gift from God.
How close are the two of you?
Oh, I love that girl. She's my daughter from another mother. You know, I watched her play tennis when she was 13 when we'd moved to a new place, and I have four sons, and I wanted them to know kids before September. I watched this girl, beautiful, funny, whooped that boy, and we got in a long conversation. I said, Maria, I want you to be my daughter from another mother. I have four sons. I'll introduce you to my two middle sons. You pick one out, grow up, and marry him. And she did.
Yeah, I get the sense that you just make things happen, Ginny. So that doesn't surprise me. All right, Virginia Ginny Smithers Sanders, a Somerville swimming legend. And now having spoken to her, I think we can all agree, just a living legend in general. Ginny, thank you so much for coming from Dana-Farber to join us and share your story.
It was a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, too.
You take care of yourself.
I will. Thanks. You as well.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, that is our show for today. What a treat. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.